This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you until 2 p.m. talking today about two books that are related in a very strange way, covering much of the same territory in very different ways over a course of some two centuries. The first factual and interpretive, the second wildly imaginative. A book I received a couple of months ago was an outcome of the 200th anniversary of the Lewis and Clark expedition, the core of discovery that crossed from the upper Missouri, from the Missouri really starting in St. Louis, all the way to the up the Missouri, across the Rockies, and down the Columbia to the Pacific Ocean, and then back. It drew a lot of attention, as it does periodically, and many people think of this as one of the turning points in American history, the part, something that really defined what America would become as a nation. But there are other nations that were also affected by this expedition, and they haven't been heard from nearly as much. A new book that came out this spring is called Lewis and Clark Through Indian Eyes, and it contains nearly a dozen essays by various writers giving their interpretation of exactly what the Lewis and Clark expedition meant. The longest and most comprehensive of these is, get the exact title, is Our People Have Always Been Here by Roberta Connor, better known as Bobby, and I believe we have her on the line. Are you there, Bobby?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you for joining us today. You are tell us a little bit about yourself, because I am afraid I might mispronounce some things.
Thank you. My Indian name is Sisawipum, and I am a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, which is comprised of Cayuse, Umatilla, and Walla Walla tribes, as we're now known. And I am the director of Temastlik Cultural Institute, which is a tribal museum on the Oregon and Lewis and Clark trails.
And your people, the various different tribes or nations you've mentioned, were all hosts to Lewis and Clark 200 years ago.
Correct, although our identifications by those names are not in the journals, except for the Walla Wallas. It's the only name that you would recognize with contemporary monikers.
And I guess even then they didn't call themselves Walla Wallas, but that was just the name of the river.
That's correct. There were many people in that area who referred to themselves, and still do today, as Wallulapum.
Now, when Lewis and Clark came through, they were quite impressed by the reception they got in west of the, well, they were impressed by the reception they got everywhere, but especially west of the Rockies as they approached the Pacific, and they built a fort on the Pacific, stayed there over the winter, and then returned, getting back in 1806. How did the people, your people, receive them?
Well, Lewis and Clark were impressed both positively and negatively, and they reflected their impressions in the journals. But our tribespeople here were, by all standards, very hospitable and very eager to help the expedition for a variety of reasons. We were noted by both Captains Clark and Lewis as honest, sincere, and hospitable.
And yet, barely 50 years later, these people who had been so hospitable were basically dispossessed of their land, and some people who may have been young children when Lewis and Clark passed through may have had to endure the displacement as old, as much as elderly people.
Correct. There were young men, chief lawyer of the Nez Perce people, as well as Timothy or Timutsu, who is one of my ancestors, and old Joseph, and Peel Peel Mox Mux. Many of these leaders at the 1855 Treaty Council in Walla Walla were infants and toddlers and young children when Lewis and Clark arrived in our homeland. And they would see their hospitality serve them no protection from the westward expansionism of the United States, as the railroad surveys and gold miners and settlers rolled into our country and began to stake claims long before we were dispossessed of our lands.
Now, when Lewis and Clark, Lewis had been President Jefferson's personal secretary, and Clark was an experienced frontiersman. When they went west, they were the first representatives of the American government to follow that particular route. But there had been many other Europeans there before. How had the natives of your area, the native people, responded to the other Europeans?
Well, our people had made forays as well out of our homeland, but generally speaking, the Bitterroots and the Rocky Mountains, as well as the Blue Mountains and the Great Celilo Falls on the Columbia, the Long Narrow, and the land to the north of us had protected us from almost all contact with Euro-Americans until the arrival of Lewis and Clark. We have oral histories that describe two French voyageurs being in our homeland before them, but we don't have, of course, a record of that, so that is left to rely on oral history. But when Lewis and Clark arrived, they found that we already possessed guns and a European sailor's jacket and scarlet and blue wool, as well as brass and other metal objects. So it was clear that our trade network allowed us contact with many other people, French, Spanish, British, and Russian. And that contact began early in the 1700s, and with the arrival of trade goods, probably more numerous than previous centuries, on the Pacific Ocean. There had been more than 100 ships to the coast of the Pacific by the time Lewis and Clark come overland to our country.
And what was, do you have any idea what the native attitude toward these interlopers were?
Well,
I know in some cases the trade was very positive, but there might have been a bit of worry.
They were, up until the point that Lewis and Clark arrive in our homeland, there had been no interlopers of record here. The tribes all around us, including our neighbors and relatives, the Nez Perce, had already been to Fort Mandan while Lewis and Clark wintered there and knew of Lewis and Clark and their plans to come west. So we were not without information, and we were eager. We have historic enemies, and our enemies to the south, the Bannocks or Northern Paiutes and the Shoshonean peoples, had weapons because they had horses before we did. That's how we acquired our first horses, and they had weapons. And for us, the Blackfeet, the Shoshone, and the Bannock, if they were well-armed, we needed to be well-armed. And so as with all people who are looking to protect a homeland and their own people, we were eager to have the most modern means of protection and against our foes. And we were eager to trade with Lewis and Clark because they had what could be considered the coolest, newest products in our neighborhood. The other reason that I think we were eager to be hospitable with them goes way back into our cultural philosophy, and that is we are taught, because the Creator gave us such an abundance in our homeland, our culture teaches us to take care of those who are less well off than ourselves, and to be grateful for how much we've been given. And so it was clear that these people needed help. They were precariously existing in our homeland. They did not know how to live off of our land. They had a distaste for some of our most abundant foods. And so we knew that we had to help them in order for them to move on, in addition to ensure future trade opportunities.
And yet they also ate foods that you weren't so fond of, like dogs and horses.
That's correct. Our people did, when necessity called for it, eat horse meat, although that was not a preferred part of our diet ever, and did jerk horse meat. But we did not ever consume dogs. We had had dogs in our homes as domestic companions and helpers for all of our history on this landscape, and the Aboriginal dog was a member of the family. And in 2 days, for example, on their outbound journey in October of 1805, the expedition bought 66 dogs in our homeland. So they, as they said, supped heartily on things we were not accustomed to eating.
But they did come. You were kind to them. They passed through going one way. They returned the other way. Was there any fear of what would follow them, or was the desire to get the coolest new things stronger than that?
Well, I think one of the motivations for our hospitality also comes from something you learn in international business classes, which is if you really want to know the true intention of your guests, it's important to spend time with them. And we wanted them to stay for a couple of reasons. They were eager to leave, but we knew that the spring runoff had not begun in earnest, and so by the level of the Columbia River and the tributaries. And so we knew that it didn't matter if they hurried out of our homeland into the Bitterroots, because they wouldn't be able to get out, as they eventually proved to be right. But we wanted them to stay because we wanted to know their true intentions. And what our history reflects is the other side of the story that's not in the journals. For example, on April 28th in 1806, on the banks of the Columbia River, we had what appeared to Lewis and Clark a song fest and a celebration where they sang songs for us and we sang songs, and they noted that there was a medicine man present who could foretell things. When we look at what they're describing in the journals, we see very distinctly that it was a prayer service, nothing akin to a modern powwow, but a prayer service just like we still hold in our longhouses today, where the songs that are sung are prayers, and the movements of the dancers are prayerful and reverential. And that night was the announcement of the fulfillment of the prophecy that our lives would be changed forever, and if we survived, we would be strong again someday. So I think we were aware that change was coming. It was all around us. We had been protected for a good period of time compared to the people in the east and everywhere east of us, basically. But we knew that we could not stay as we were forever with the arrival of these new people. And it wasn't just the Americans. There was a earnest competition between the British and the Americans in our homeland, and it immediately followed Lewis and Clark within the decade. So I think our awareness was there that change would come, not only through prophecies, but through the trade goods and our forays out into other lands. And we had to prepare for it. And knowing their intentions required us to spend as much time with them as possible, but they wanted to leave.
Now, 50 years later, as you mentioned, the Treaty of Walla Walla essentially took away the vast majority of the land, or reserved a very small part for the Indian tribes in that area. And the population declined precipitously. I guess it had already been declining before Lewis and Clark arrived because of the spread of diseases. I don't know if that affected your people as much as some of the others. But it was a disastrous time for the Indians of that region. But you said your people knew that if they were going to survive, they would come out of this strong again. Is that what's happening now?
We hope that's true. We hope that this is the fulfillment of the prophecy. And it's hard to know that it's all coming to pass, but we know that we are stronger economically than we've been in the last 150 years. We know that we have the ability to determine more about our future than we have had in the last 25 years than we've had prior to that for 150 years. And we have, I think, a stronger sense of our own ability to change our future than we've had for the last 150 years. It's difficult to imagine how people who had complete independence and autonomy in village lives and through kinship systems managed their affairs in a 7 to 10 million acres for our tribes, including the joint use areas with our neighbors, how going from that to 512,000 acres, which was what we set aside in our treaty negotiation, how vastly different our lives would be. It's very difficult to imagine going from millions of acres to a 500,000 acres. And within 16 years, the government would survey the reservation boundaries, and they would lop off 262,000 acres by drawing a straight line over a disputed location in the Treaty Council minutes. And that would become 250,000 acres. And by 1885, 30 years later, with the Slater Allotment Act, it would become 158,000 acres, broken up into allotment parcels of 40, 80, and 160 acres. And so the advent of the most oppression and the advent of the most dire changes would begin with the Treaty Council, wherein we are no longer in charge of our lands, no longer in charge of our lives, and no longer free to choose where and how we will live in the future. And that change begins 49 years and 7 months after Lewis and Clark first arrived here.
But you say you are now economically stronger than ever before. How did that come about?
A number of things. The editor of this book, Alvin Josephi, had the opportunity in 1969 to write a position paper for the Nixon administration. That position paper, 6 years later, would result in legislation that became known as the Indian Self-Determination Act, in which tribes would be allowed, finally, following the Eisenhower administration's policy of termination, it would reverse that notion that reservation lands and the collection of our peoples as tribal identities would have value, and we would have the idea returned to prominence that we could control our destiny by virtue of our own decision-making. And that Indian Self-Determination Act began to turn things around in 1975. In the last 30 years, then, our tribes have constructed a grain elevator. We're in the middle of wheat country. We have created a man-made lake that is an improved campground area. We have a truck stop and a mini-mart, as well as a $45 million resort that includes not only Temescal Cultural Institute, but our 18-hole championship golf course and RV park, hotel, and casino. So we have gone from about 42% unemployment in the 1980s to about 16% unemployment, and we went from having no one employee, I guess, for most of our modern history to now having 1,100 employees and the second largest employer in the region. So that's a dramatic turnabout, and half of our employees are Indian and half of our employees are non-Indian, and we are an economic leader in our region, and we could not have said that when I graduated from high school here over 30 years ago.
And you mentioned in your essay that you've started buying land back.
We have. It's not easy to buy land back. The land got sold for incredibly low rates, if paid for at all in some instances. And people see the casino and dollar signs flash before them, and they want more than market value to sell these lands back to the tribe sometimes. We also have great neighbors who have decided to sell us at very reasonable rates, and we have to be grateful to them. But we have restored thousands of acres to tribal jurisdiction since in the last 10 years.
In your essay, you cover a lot of the ground we've just covered now, but one of the major points that you make, you ask the question of, was the Lewis and Clark Expedition part of a deliberate imperial program? The heading is Innocent Journey or Reconnaissance for an Empire. And then you go into pretty great detail to show that it was reconnaissance for an empire.
Well, it's important. I think that much of America's fascination with the Lewis and Clark Expedition and the 33 members who came out into our country, including many mixed-blood people in the Corps, there's a fascination with the historic, ethnographic, and naturalist components of the expedition, and those are extremely important and laudable records that Lewis and Clark made for Western science as well as cultural information. But people tend not to see the larger picture, which is that the doctrine of discovery had already been employed when Spain and Portugal were the world powers. Papal bulls were created that reflected how dispossession could occur to take native lands, not just on this continent, but elsewhere. And certainly being heathen was one criteria that was later added to the roster of ways to dispossess natives. And obviously the first two were by treaty or by conquest. And later that was modified. And there's a new work out by Professor Robert Miller from Lewis and Clark Law School that talks specifically about how this doctrine of discovery then travels across the waters to the United States. This new young nation uses the same doctrine of discovery to acquire discoverers' rights. And basically that's what the Louisiana Purchase is the acquisition not of the land but of the discoverers' rights. And so that purchase, which does not include the Pacific Northwest, is clearly the greatest movement of Western expansion in one fell swoop by the Jefferson administration. But the Lewis and Clark Corps of Discovery is a military expedition dispatched by a president of a young, ambitious nation that hopes to go from sea to shining sea. And what Lewis and Clark record is important, but also they're carving their names on the landscape and dates. They are providing evidence and proof with structures like Fort Clatsop and Fort Mandan that they have been here, and they leave behind evidence with every tribe they hold a diplomatic council with, this kind of evidence, peace medals and flags that say that the Americans have been here. So they leave evidence all along the trail that they have been out into this country and that we, in these diplomacy councils they conduct, should now do business with the Americans over any other interest. And we should not take up arms against the government of the United States or ally with any other interest of any other country. So when you look at that military expedition's orders from President Jefferson, you understand that it was not merely a scientific or ethnographic expedition.
And you even quote something from Meriwether Lewis, which it's language that we're very familiar with from later in the century, but I had no idea that it was being used this early. And he stated, in August 3rd, 1804, the great chief of the 17 great nations of America, because there were 17 states at that time, impelled by his parental regard for his newly adopted children on the troubled waters, has sent us to clear the road, remove every obstruction, and make it the road of peace between himself and his red children residing there. Do you know specifically who he was addressing?
Let's see. In August of 1804, he would not yet have reached the Mandan Villages, so he would have been on the Missouri River in the Dakotas.
So in that case, it was territory which the U.S. did have a claim toward. But he spoke somewhat similarly all the way to the Pacific.
Yes, and what's fascinating about that is 49 years and 7 months later, the treaty commissioners, Isaac Stevens, a governor of the Washington Territory, and Superintendent of Indian Affairs Joel Palmer of the Oregon Territory, would use Lewis and Clark to invoke references to not only how good our people had been to Lewis and Clark and how Lewis and Clark had not made trouble. We would be reminded of Lewis and Clark in the Treaty Council so that the commissioners can basically argue to us that the Great White Father wants to take care of his good red children. So this doesn't end in 1804 and 5 and 6. We hear this language again just about 50 years later as we're asked to cede with our neighboring tribes, the Yakimas and the Nez Perce, more than 30 million acres.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm talking with Bobby Connor, who is the director of the Cultural Institute at the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Southern Washington. She's one of the authors of the essays in Lewis and Clark Through Indian Eyes. And as I mentioned before, it's the longest and probably the most comprehensive essay in the book. Well, thank you so much for talking with us. And I hope that things continue to progress as well for your people as they have in the last two decades.
Thank you, Eric. And I'm grateful to you. Our homeland does extend into southeastern Washington, but our headquarters are in northeastern
Oregon. Excuse me. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for being with us. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'm linking together some otherwise widely and wildly disparate books in this afternoon's program. In the first half, we talked with Bobby Connor from one of the essayists in Lewis and Clark Through Indian Eyes, recounting how the Lewis and Clark expedition affected the Indians whose land it passed through and how it continues to have an effect even now, 200 years later. Well, about 200 years after that expedition, a young woman from a fictional young woman from the San Francisco Bay Area took just about the opposite course, heading from California through Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, into South Dakota, to find herself and figure out where her life was going. She's a woman named Jane, no last name, but apparently of at least partially Norwegian descent, and she's the heroine of Catherine Bramkamp's novel Woman on the Verge of Wyoming. Catherine Bramkamp is a Nevada County native, Nevada City native at that, and will be here this Saturday to present her book in Grass Valley, and we have her on the line now. Welcome to Booktown.
Thank you, Eric.
So, Jane, she doesn't have a last name.
No, I wanted her to be more of an archetypal person. So it's just, you know, it's Jane, C. Jane Wren, Run, Jane, run, that kind of thing.
And run she did.
Yes.
Although she actually spent almost no time in the book in Wyoming itself.
No, she doesn't.
And most of the time she spends in South Dakota,
mm-hmm.
and especially in Sioux Falls. From the little bit I know you very slightly. I know your brother somewhat better. He was a good friend of my nephew's and your parents. And so I can say pretty fairly that most of this book is not autobiographical.
That is correct.
But the sites where you set it are ones that you must be very familiar with.
Yes. I retracked when I was a child. My mother still is from South Dakota. It wasn't just when I was a child. But my mom and my dad and my brother and I would travel across that route every summer. So I wanted to recreate that, not only the past of it, which is the kind of nostalgia of what was it like in the 60s and 70s when you could drive it 95 miles across Nevada and there was no problem, and of course you got a ticket in Utah, but also to talk about the differences now and then, just because it struck me the last time I was there how much things had changed.
And it is sort of a love letter to South Dakota, I would say.
Thank you. It is. I am extraordinarily fond of Sioux Falls. It's like the prototypical town to me. It's like the perfect town, and I just adore it. And my mother, you know, obviously grew up there, and for her it was very stifling, and she wanted to leave because it wasn't a fit for her. She's better off in California. So, Jane goes back, and it has a real appeal for her, and I think for a lot of people, that small-town feel that's manageable.
Although the small town is manageable, and she's sort of enchanted by the people, the old family friends she runs into, but she doesn't feel enough at home there to stay,
no.
And she doesn't really have the same kind of significant encounters that she does with other people in other places along the way.
Yeah, and that's partially what I get from my mom, who loves her friends from there. I love her friends from there, but it's just not the same. And anybody from California who goes to the Midwest or goes to the East Coast can feel that there's a difference, especially if you're a native. It's a very different, people have a different way of approaching things. They have a different way of just being in the world than you're used to if you're from way out California. And who knew it was so way out until I went back east to find that out.
Did you say East Coast?
Well, Midwest, East Coast.
Even there, having spent a lot of time in both the Midwest and the actual East Coast, I completely agree, because I find that I love it in both places when I return, but I couldn't stay there.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell us a bit more about Jane. She's the archetypal midlife crises mm-hmm. mother with just grown children. You say somewhere in here that when you... your children grow up, you move from being middle management to being a consultant.
A consultant, yeah.
Which is pretty much the same as being unemployed.
Yes. My friend would like to point out that, my friend Lester Rose would like to point out that he is taking credit for the consultant/unemployed quote.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'll go on record and let him have that.
Now, your kids are not yet completely grown up.
I have an 18-year-old in college, and I have a 20-year-old who's living at home, but he works full-time. So I'm pretty retired.
So in that regard, your life, you know what the empty nest is like.
Yes, yes. And there's, I think what's interesting is when I talk to women my age, even younger with young children, all of them will say things like, I want to run away from home. So this is something that women consider in maybe even your darkest moments, maybe not, but it's like, what would it be like to just leave? And I made it easier with Jane, because I don't think that one would ever leave small children, but when they're grown up a little bit, it's not so hard to imagine just driving away.
In this case, she does it with no premeditation.
Yeah, none. And that's part of the adventure, is can you do that? Yeah, well, if you have a credit card and a car, yes.
Yes, although it's a little harder if your car breaks down in the middle of Nevada and mm-hmm. you're wearing high heels.
That was kind of, I have a friend of mine who said that she just could barely tolerate that scene because she kept thinking of the pantyhose and the high heels and the suit. She's like, oh, I was so uncomfortable until Jane could get changed.
I was going to wait a while to bring this up, but I guess we'll have to get to it now. What's with the pantyhose? It's
right.
one of her great obsessions in
yeah.
here, and I don't know of any place where people are required to wear pantyhose anymore.
Oh, have you been to Dallas recently?
No, I haven't.
Okay, it's the land of pantyhose. They still make them and they still wear them, apparently. In Northern California, it's hard to imagine that. But I put Jane in pantyhose just because, again, it was part of what that business feel was for her. It was the constriction of that. And so when she shifts into wearing no pantyhose, open-toed shoes, you know, more comfortable clothes, it is a big issue for women. You know, you have to, when you dress up, you have to really dress up, and guys can throw on a tie and go. And whether that's fair or not is immaterial. It's just I wanted to show what the constriction was from her old life to her new life.
But all along, even though she gets liberal, she takes, I shouldn't say liberal, liberated to some degree, she still is a somewhat obsessive shopper and
mm-hmm.
Maker-upper, I'm
yeah.
not sure.
Yeah, you can't leave yourself completely behind, and I hope I stayed true to her character, because you can't just go completely. I mean, she'd like to be very creative, like some of the women that she meets in the Black Hills, but you just can't. She's getting there, but she just can't get there all the way. So hopefully, by her destination, she can relax even more.
And that's one of the things that I felt quite appealing about the book, is that it's even if I didn't know you and your family a little bit, I could have told, I think, that it's not autobiographical, because Jane couldn't have written this book. Some of the people she met, maybe Caroline, the artist, could have,
mm-hmm.
but Jane couldn't have.
No, and I wanted her to be, well, first of all, as a writer, you want to create a character that's her own self, as opposed to creating me again, because Lord knows there's enough of me to go around. You have to do it again. But to let her be this constricted, limited character, so that I could, and I hope that I succeeded, to create a person who goes through life within her own methods and with her own boundaries. And no, she couldn't write the book, because that's the point. She's looking for her own creativity.
So now that you've brought yourself up, tell us a bit about your literary background. This is your second book.
This is my second book, first novel. I have a background in first-person essay writing, and I was a columnist for the local paper here in Sonoma County for 3 years doing the essays, and that's the basis for the first book, Being Misbehaved. And then I'm working on two more novels. So this will be my first run at it.
And Misbehaved is a very, to say the least, counterintuitive advice columnist.
Yes.
And you quote her several times mm-hmm. in the book. I almost suspected, even though I knew you had written a book like this before, I almost thought that Misbehaved, if there were a real such person, might be like Miss Lonely Hearts and actually be a man.
Oh, that's interesting. That would be an interesting twist, wouldn't it? I've always pictured Misbehaved as being female and very involved in pop culture and very involved in what is really going on with people, so that she can give the worst advice you could ever hope for. Because it's like it's the antidote to Dear Abby or to anything. It's like, why are we doing the quote right thing, and who's decided that?
And you felt, when you say she's a person who's completely immersed in pop culture, does that fit with you as well?
I don't know if I'm driven by pop culture, but I certainly understand its influences, and so I want to reflect that, because that's how people relate, is that you can make pop culture. A lot of novels will make pop cultural references as a shorthand, and I don't want to go that route, because then you date your books very quickly. But at the other side of it, if you're writing, you know, for your audience, you need to know what they're immersed in so that you can relate. So I pay attention to it.
You started out writing the column.
Mm-hmm.
You've written, it says on the jacket, some 300 newspaper and magazine articles.
Yes.
And what moved you toward fiction?
I think I've always wanted to do fiction. The nonfiction articles do pay. So I've made some money doing regular, you know, your standard articles. I write for the a New York Times publication up here in Sonoma County, Santa Rosa Magazine. So I can, you know, kind of have money coming in that way. But my first love has always been novels. I have 2 degrees in English. I love the form of the novel, the art of the novel. That's what I want to, you know, move forward doing. Whether or not it makes a ton of money, that remains to be seen yet. My husband's still waiting on that.
How has the book been received?
It's been received very well. I get a lot of good feedback from my writers, from readers. I get good feedback from Misbehaved. I have people who have read those articles, and also I did an article for Chicken Soup for the Writer's Soul, which is still on the shelf, and I have people writing me after reading that saying it touched me and I really appreciate it, and that kind of thing is really exciting to hear about when you're a writer.
And what are the novels you have coming up? Are they like this, or?
One of them is similar. One of them is called Earthquake Weather, and it's about more suburban life in the suburbs rather than having anybody go away. And then I'm working on the prototype for a mystery series, so I'm wrestling with that.
Now, I would have considered Marin County suburban. I don't think of Sonoma County as being suburban, or has it changed in the 30 years since I've spent much time there?
Sonoma County has a good mix. It has some huge suburban tracks, and so you can find some of that prototypical suburban behavior in parts of the east and west side of Petaluma, for instance, the southwest part of Santa Rosa. Roanoke Park is what you think of when you think of suburbs. You can find pieces of it. And then on the flip side, you're driving through cows, fields, you're driving through grapes, you're driving through wineries. So it has an interesting mix. But you certainly can find that kind of behavior in the Sonoma County area, definitely.
But you put your heroine in Marin instead,
yes,
a little closer to the city. Is that because it's such an easy target, or...?
partially the character, I thought of her as as somebody who was more of a composite of a lot of what I used to hear from my mother-in-law, who used to be a real estate agent in Marin. And so I had those stories and some attitudes, and I could base things on that. I had a couple of real estate agents read the book, and they said, "Oh, well, you certainly nailed Marin, didn't you?" I said, "I guess I've been listening."
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm talking with Catherine Bramkamp, author most recently of Woman on the Verge of Wyoming. She'll be coming to town this Saturday at 2 o'clock in a location I cannot name, but you will probably hear about either from on the KVMR community calendar or very likely from her mother. The family is different enough from your own family that you haven't ruffled any feathers that way.
Yes and no. My mom spends a lot of time telling her friends that she's not the mother.
Mm-hmm. I would think that would be obvious.
I thought so, but her friends are still saying things like, "Did you wear Birkenstocks?" And she's like, "No, it's fiction." So she's having a little bit of a, not a challenge certainly, but it's like, no, it's not based, on my mother. It's just, we needed a mother, we needed a daughter, you need those kinds of conflicts.
It was very handy that, her friend Caroline, Jane's new friend Caroline, at some point quotes Virginia Woolf as saying that what a woman needs is a room of her own and an independent income.
Uh-huh.
And you say that for somebody to do what Jane did, she needs a credit card and a car.
Right.
This wouldn't have been possible probably for, your average working stiff couldn't have done what Jane does in this book.
That's right. It's more of a middle class ability, I guess. Not that any woman might want to think about running away, but Jane had to have all those other things in place: the middle class background, the friends along the way, the sense that you could just pick up and go. That's not typical. Let's say.
Were you ever afraid that this might make it a little precious, that it might be, ordinary people would read this and say, well, what's she got to worry about? She's got it made.
Well, that's true, but I think that people read to escape as opposed to specifically look for themselves. So, I tried to make her as universal as I could given who she is.
So did you write it as escape?
Yeah, I did write it as escape. I did write it to... I was just curious. I kept thinking, what would happen if you just did this? If you just turned the car around and what kinds of things would you come across and what kind of adventures, if you were really focused on that, would you get? And so that's where I went with it. My friends are always asking me, do you want to run away? Well, I don't need to run away. I'm fine.
And working on your, your two. What is it like writing two novels at the same time?
Well, it's busy. I can go back and forth, though. I have one of the novels, The Earthquake Weather, is out with my writing group. So they're tearing it up as per my request. And so while they do that, then I work on the other book. And then when I get The Earthquake Weather back, I'll work on that. And I go back and forth. And it's not too confusing, at least not so far.
And do you still write articles for...
Yeah.
For pin money or bread and butter money or
yes.
whatever?
Yes, I do.
What you said here on the back that most recently for Modern Maturity, does that mean your last article or your last 10 or?
I had a couple articles that I sent off to Modern Maturity. The one that made it was the article called Flower Babies, and it was about my son when he was in junior high. The junior high group gets in there. Sex education, they get a baby 5-pound flower bag that's called a baby, and they have to take care of it for a week. And so he, not only did he have some adventures with his flower baby, but his friends did. And so I compiled that all up into a little article and sold it to Modern Maturity.
And are most of your articles like that, little snapshots of your life? Or?
Oh, the first person, definitely the first person ones, like the experience of the flower babies. The articles that I write for Santa Rosa Magazine, I write about things that I have one series that I do on children and what they can do, in the area of Santa Rosa, since that's what it's focused on. And then I also run a series on philanthropists, and I do profiles on philanthropists locally. So those are, what you consider, nonfiction, real, informational articles.
Which are a lot?
I do a lot.
Yeah. What length?
The philanthropy articles are about 400 words. The children's articles are about 6 to 8. They have a budget, so I can't go over too much. They pay me by the word.
Mm-hmm. When you write a novel, you don't get paid by the word.
That's right. I can do whatever I want.
Is it more satisfying?
Yeah, I would say definitely. Because you get to use your own words, you use your own experiences, and you can go off on using language and syntax that an editor may or may not put up with in the format of a magazine or a compilation. But in your own novel, you can just go. And some of the better novels don't even have editors like Virginia Woolf. It's all about her work.
This was published by Author House, which I assume is some sort of co-op of authors, or?
It's a press on demand, print on demand.
Mm-hmm.
So I pay to have it published, and I pay to promote it, and I pay to edit it, and it's all about me doing it. And then when the books are ordered, they're printed. So there's no inventory. Although I have inventory for the coming weekend.
And you said edit, and I was guessing that it was something sort of like that, and that one of the advantages of doing it yourself was you didn't have an editor sitting over your shoulder, but you actually did pay someone to give you advice?
My last book I did, this book I didn't, and I think that was probably a mistake. I have some friends now who are going into the editing business, and I'll have them edit like both Earthquake Weather and the next book coming up. Just more for typos, syntax, things that I miss, because you just miss it when you're the writer.
That was the one thing I was going to point out. The only startling thing about it were some of the typos and
yeah.
an occasional syntactical strangeness.
Yeah, my writing group would tell you that in a minute. I say, you have the quirkiest stuff, and they just look at me and shake their heads. But so that's the one thing that I would do. But you have to, I had to pay for it myself, and I didn't have the budget this round.
Are you going to put all your books through your writer's group? Did you put Misbehaved through it?
Misbehaved.
Of course, those were essays you already wrote, or
yeah,
columns you already wrote.
Yeah, I published that before we set up. I set up the writer's group while I was getting my master's. In creative writing, and it came out of that. So the Misbehaved book came before I got my master's. So that was pre-writing group. But it helps to have a group of creative, sympathetic people who can say, this makes no sense, this does make sense. It's really a valuable tool for me.
You say that you set it up. Was it as if, do you all discuss each other's writings,
mm-hmm.
or has it been more that you've been having them discuss yours?
It depends on what people are writing. So when we were working on, when one of my friends was working on her novel for her thesis project, we spent a lot of time with her. Right now, I'm sending stuff around, and then sometimes we've got short stories. So it's very fluid, but that would be right, about right for writers.
Right. And but all of the people in your group are serious. They're all planning to have things published.
Yes.
Okay. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've been talking with Catherine Bramkamp, who I imagine many people in Nevada County still remember, or certainly remember other members of her family. She'll be here this Saturday at 2 p.m. at a undisclosed location in Grass Valley, which I hope the word will get out one way or another. And actually, if people want to know more about that, can they go to your website? Is there any information about the Saturday event there?
There is, and my website is misbehaved.com.
Okay, and that's M-I-S-S.
Yes.
Behaved.
Make sure two S's get put in, otherwise it's going to be very exciting.
Oh, have you tried it?
Yes.
Oh, maybe I should too.
Maybe you should too. I try to keep people on. Just M-I-S-S, it's okay.
M-I-S-S-S. MISSBEHAVED.com.
Yep.
Okay, thanks very much, Catherine. I'll see you on Saturday.
Thank you, Eric.
This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and just a couple of things before Mr. James Accardi comes in to follow me with his rock and roll party. An event coming up this evening in Nevada City, Linda Cohen and Joan Bechtel, who are the authors of Motherhood Confidential, The Strange Disappearance of My Best Friend. They were guests on this program last fall, and they will be appearing at the Madeline Helling Library this evening. That's tonight, June 26th, at 7 p.m. at the community room of the Madeline Helling Library. It's described as a dual comic reading from the book and a discussion of the book. And in Booktown news, this program has been going on for nearly 6 years now, and I've been getting more and more pressure, or more and more requests from people who would like to be on. And I've finally sort of given in. I can't do a show every week because that would mean depriving us of Zen Tech, and nobody, myself least of all, would want to do that. So I have started doing online-only programs. I've just completed one, and it appeared on the archive of Booktown programs. We now have about 25 programs archived. I'll be putting on every new program unless there's a glitch of some sort. And you can get to this archive by either going to the Booktown listing and the KVMR program guide. You go to the program schedule, and there's a link that will take you to the Booktown website, and that will take you to all of the 25 programs that are on right now. The one we did that has just gone on was an interview with Eric Blem, the author of The Last Season, which is a story of Randy Morganson, a backcountry park ranger who disappeared mysteriously in 1996. And Eric Blem spent quite some time looking into the disappearance and finally telling everybody what really happened. In the second interview, it's with Peter Hessler, who is the New Yorker correspondent in China. He wrote a wonderful book on about his Peace Corps years in China called Rivertown a few years ago, and his new one is called Oracle Bones, A Journey Through the Past and Present of China. It's also a very good book. And if you want to hear either of those interviews, as I say, you can go to the Booktown link on the program guide, the program schedule from the KVMR program guide. That is on kvmr.org. When I say program guide, I don't mean the written one. I mean the online one. Go to the kvmr.org, click on program schedule, and there'll be a Booktown link. You can also go to booktown.blogspot.com, and that'll take you directly to all the descriptions of the shows and all of the 25, 26 shows that we have on right now. So as I mentioned, this has been Booktown, and Mr. James Accardi is coming up with his rock and roll party.